Session number 9173, Reel 15.
Proposals for substantially amending the whole thing to the detriment of the Turks, certainly so soon after independence, because after all it had only been 3 years, and to start talking about a fundamental revision of the provisions of the Constitution at that stage did seem to me reckless, and it was bound to produce a strong reaction from the Turks.
This seems, though, to have confirmed your fears about the Greek Cypriot response to the provisions for the Turkish Cypriots.
Yes. Well, it's a very complicated story, this period from 1960 independence up to the breakdown of the Constitution at the end of 1963, and there were rights and wrongs on both sides. I wasn't there and haven't the intimate knowledge that others have of that period. But really the question that arises is whether the two sides wanted to make the Constitution work or not. There's been a lot of argument from the Greek Cypriot side that the Constitution was in fact unworkable and had been imposed on them. The German president of the Constitutional Court said at the time that the Constitution was, in his view, perfectly workable, but that it did require goodwill on the part of the two communities, which apparently didn't exist. And I should have thought that was a fair judgment. So it wasn't the Constitution itself, clumsy and difficult though it wasn't the Constitution itself that was unworkable. It was simply that the necessary basis of goodwill was lacking. Now, the Constitution had specifically ruled out enesis and partition and any activity leading to those ends. However, immediately after the signing of the agreement and certainly immediately after independence, Greek Cypriot leaders, including the Archbishop himself, continued to make statements about independence being only a stepping stone towards a self-determination, and of course the Turks countered with somewhat similar statements about the problem not having been settled, that there never would be a settlement probably unless people accepted the unavoidable need for some physical separation of the two peoples.
Do you think yourself, Mr. Redaway, that Makarios was sincere when he accepted independence in 1959?
Well, it is a big question, and I must say that many people do believe that he was sincere and had made a sincere conversion to independence. If you speak to Western diplomats who served in Cyprus after independence, almost to a man, they assure you that Makarios had a real change of heart, and although he had to go through the form of continuing to preach enesis to look forward to the ultimate union of Cyprus with Greece, that in fact he was content with independence and intended that to be the end of the road. When you ask them to specify, oddly enough, they usually just reply, "Oh well, Makarios told me so," which is a bit naive for experienced diplomats. What is certainly beyond question is that he became attached to the idea of self-rule in Cyprus, If it had ever come to it, I'm sure he would have driven a very hard bargain with whatever regime was in power in Greece, and that the union of Cyprus to Greece would have been conditional. A very large measure of independence would have been retained in Cypriot hands. As far as he himself is concerned, I mean, some people have suggested that he had his eyes on a higher target than being just the ruler of Cyprus, and that he looked forward in the end to play a significant role in Greece itself. Well, who knows whether that is so. But there are difficulties about this view of Macarius. First of all, they're not really shared by the Greek Cypriots themselves. This is a view of him which tends to be that of observers from outside. Not very many of the Greek Cypriots appear to doubt that he was sincere and steadfast in his support of Enesis, and it, in a way, it would be a little surprising if he'd made a switch ex animo and from his heart, because of his background and upbringing. Moreover, there is the difficulty, of course, of if he was not, after all, sincere in seeking Enesis, why did he send all those young men to their deaths and to kill other people? It calls into question not merely his political sagacity, but also the morality of his motivation. Because he could have got a form of independence and probably in time complete independence by a different road, by the road of cooperation and constitutional development. So it's difficult, it seems to me, to reconcile the idea of his sincere conversion to independence with what he actually did. And in any case, of course, in public life, a man is what he proclaims himself to be and what he says in public, not really what may go on in the secrecy of his heart. For myself, I would give him, so to speak, the credit of remaining steadfast to his ideal of Enesis. If he did become converted, then it wasn't in 1957, but rather in 1967, when the Turks were clearly on the brink of invading Cyprus, and he may, at last, too late, have woken up to the fact that Enesis really was a very, very a dangerous and unrewarding game. Certainly, after independence, as I've said, he continued to preach Enesis, and the record is full of remarks in public by him, which could only be interpreted as saying that he was viewing independence as a stepping stone to union with Greece. It's said, of course, that, well, he was just playing to the gallery, that the Greek Cypriots expected him to do this, and that he had to maintain his own position anyway against political opposition by this. That may be so, but there is some serious evidence on the other side. I don't know whether you've heard of the Akritas plan. Now, this was a highly secret plan, prepared on Makarios's orders by his Minister of the Interior, who'd been one of Grievous's lieutenants and was a very dangerous, and I would say myself, a very foolish man, Polycarpos Yorkagis. He prepared it in 1963 in collaboration with some Greek army officers then serving in Cyprus. And it was a secret plan with three objectives. First of all, to get rid of the treaties, or at least those parts of the treaties which prevented unrestricted self-determination and union with Greece. Secondly, to convince the world that the constitution was unworkable, that therefore it had to be amended so as to get rid of the Turkish safeguards. And finally, a scheme for suppressing any reaction from the Turkish community and, in effect, reducing them to the status of a politically impotent minority. Well, now, this plan was first revealed, disclosed, in a Greek newspaper in Athens in 1966, I think April 1966, Patris. And it was disclosed because I suppose the editor wanted to expose Makarios or something of that kind, perhaps expose a Greek policy for not supporting him sufficiently. I can't remember now. But if it is authentic, then it really is conclusive proof that Makarios was not, as I think some people have said, simply genuinely trying to get amendments in order to make the constitution more workable, but was working to a secret plan designed to overthrow the whole of the 1960 settlement. Now, of course, since this was published, the Turks have seized on it and trot it out on every possible occasion. And they say that the Greeks have never denied or repudiated it. Well, that, of course, is very significant. I certainly myself haven't heard of any such such denial. Now, this puts the whole of these continued statements about ultimate union with Greece in a rather different complexion. They, in themselves, they were a violation of the settlement, because one of the clauses of the settlement was that enesis and partition and any action leading to enesis and partition would be ruled out. So in a sense, Makarios was breaking the rules, breaking the law, getting onto it at all. So that is, it really needs to be settled somehow or other whether the Acretas plan was authentic, and there doesn't seem to be much doubt that it was, in which case then that was a statement of the guiding principle. It's a pretty crazy plan as one reads it, but then of course the initiators were dangerous, and certainly Polycarpus Yorkadius was a dangerous and pretty loony man. So that needs to be taken into account. Now, on the Turkish side, it may be, people often say that they reacted badly. Within a year, they were using their power of blocking taxation in order to try to make the Greek Cypriots carry out the provisions about Turkish municipalities and the proportion of jobs for the Turks in the civil service. And it's often said that the Turks went too far. I don't know sufficient about the detail of that period to say. And then it's said that the Turks themselves walked out of the House of Representatives, or the sort of legislative council. Again, I believe that is true, that in their frustration they did in the end. And of course, that, looking back on it from their standpoint, was a great mistake. Les absents toujours tort. They lost out on it because it left the Greek Cypriot rump of the government a clear hand, and they promptly enacted legislation and so on, really bringing into force their Makarios's 13 principles, at any rate those that had the effect of doing away with the safeguards. The British role in this. Now, should we have intervened in 1963? Well, I feel myself that in principle we certainly ought to have done, because that was the time when the constitution, which had been so carefully worked out and so on, was overthrown, principally, though perhaps not entirely, as a result of Greek intransigence and determination not to make it work. And in a sense, to some very small degree, it did intervene, because Duncan Sandys went to Cyprus and told Macarius that he couldn't abrogate the treaties just like that. He'd announced that he had, and Macarius retreated a bit by saying that he merely meant to say he intended to abrogate. However, a little later they did formally abrogate the treaties. They got onto very, very dangerous ground there, and one of the disconcerting things is that apparently the British High Commissioner at the time encouraged Macarius in putting forward these dangerous proposals for the amendment of the Constitution. Indeed, Greek Cypriots say that they're knocking around somewhere in Nicosia. There is a copy of the proposals with annotations in Sir Arthur Clarke's own hand. If that is so, then I think it does expose us to quite serious charge, because anybody with the slightest acquaintance of the whole sad history of Cyprus in the previous years and the recent past would surely have perceived that this was very, very dangerous ground that Macarius was getting onto, and that it could well precipitate not merely conflict within Cyprus between the Greeks and Turks, which the Greeks might easily perhaps win, but the threat of intervention from Turkey, as it did indeed, of course, because Turkey was pretty close to invading Cyprus then. So the record doesn't stand up well. Well, now, the mere visit of a minister, Duncan Sandys, and his success in making Macarius concede that he hadn't really abrogated the treaties doesn't amount to intervention. We tried then to get Greece and Turkey to join us in some form of intervention, and really, with hindsight, it was only at any time it was only joint intervention that really was practicable in British terms. It's one thing to say we ought to have intervened to restore the constitution, and that the time when we should have intervened was when it was first overthrown in 1963, but it's another matter to say that it was practicable for us to do so. I don't remember the number of troops we had in Cyprus at the time, but the number we deployed in the United Nations peacekeeping force when it was set up was only about 2,700, and I believe that represented a very large part of the forces we had available there. Now, if we had intervened, we would have been intervening against the Greek Cypriot leadership, and therefore virtually the whole of the Greek Cypriot community, and we would have been intervening on behalf, this is how it would have appeared anyway, to Greek Cypriots and many others, on behalf of the Turkish Cypriots against the Greek Cypriot community, and we would quite soon have found ourselves enmeshed once again in a battle with the Greek Cypriots, and this time not as the legitimate government dealing with insurgents, but a foreign power intervening in the affairs of an independent republic. So I myself rather doubt whether the idea of intervention was really on anyway, unless we could have got Greece and Turkey to act together with us. Well, instead, after we had failed to get joint action by the three powers, we concentrated on setting up the United Nations peacekeeping force, and that was no doubt a sensible and wise thing, and did save a great deal of bloodshed and strife at the time. But it wasn't any substitute for intervening to restore the state of affairs established in 1960. Indeed, in a sense, it had the opposite effect, because one of the difficulties about United Nations peacekeeping forces is that in the short run, they're fine because they intervene and stop they stop conflict. But if they continue, if the deadlock drags on, then they tend to the presence of the United Nations troops tends in a way to perpetuate the very deadlock which ought to be solved, because it takes the pressure off the politicians who ought to be tackling the business of finding a settlement, and freezes the status quo, which is always, of course, inevitably to the advantage of the stronger party and to the disadvantage of the weaker party. So, although it was a good thing to do, our part in establishing the United Nations force, and particularly when it later came to be perpetuated year after year after year, was certainly no substitute for intervention.
How about the situation in 1974 when the Turks invaded?
Yes, well, I think one has to go back a little. After the breakdown of the constitution, then the Greeks, the residue of the government, which was in Greek hands, really took control. A certain degree of partition occurred, and the Turkish Cypriot refugees, I think of the order of about 30,000, took refuge in Turkish areas north of Nicosia, and there was very little cooperation from then on between the two parties. And at this stage, I think it would be true to say that Cyprus did appear to be heading for a partition. That hadn't been true during the earlier years, but antagonism increased, virtual severance of connections between the two communities, and the situation year by year got worse and worse. The Greeks Grievous came back, and indeed, he came back in 64, I think it was, and tried tough arm tactics, and indeed some dreadful atrocities did occur. For some years, Denk Taş, who'd happened to be away in Turkey, was excluded, but he was allowed to come back in 1967, and real efforts were made then to try and reach an agreement, and he and Clarides met together on a number of occasions. And certainly, well, Clarides himself has said that two or three times they really had a settlement in sight, but Makarios turned it down. If that is so, of course, Greek Cypriots must bitterly regret it now, because any settlement they could have got at that stage was bound to be much more favourable to them than anything they can get now after 1974. The Turks belatedly saw that it had been a bad mistake on their part to walk out of the government, and tried to go back, but Clarides, who was then the president of the House of Representatives, said they could only return and take their seats again if they accepted the amendments that had already been made to the Constitution and so on, which virtually were Archbishop Macarius's 13 points. United Nations had mediators there. The first was a Finn. I met him, and he seemed to have a pretty good understanding of the situation. But his successor, I think, was a South American called Galo Plaza. He went rather overboard, I should have thought, for the Greek Cypriot side, and produced proposals for a settlement which weren't in any way acceptable to the Turks, and which did tend to encourage the Greek Cypriots in the position they had taken up. Well, then I suppose we're coming on towards 1974 now, and Makarios, his relations with the government in Greece, with the colonels there, became very bad. He perhaps unwisely took them to task. A good deal of conspiracy was now going on in the background within the Turkish, within the Greek Cypriot community, and the coup d'etat occurred in July 1974, and Makarios had to run for his life, and this dreadful man Nikos Sampson took over. The colonels in Greece could hardly have chosen a worse man for the job, even from their own standpoint, because Sampson's record was so bad that nobody could seriously take him serious. Could have accepted him, I think, as an appropriate leader for the Greek Cypriot people. Then the Turks threatened to intervene and tried to get Britain to join them in intervention, failed, and they went in themselves. And they scrupulously described their action as a police operation, and to begin with, anyway, said that they were simply going in accordance with the terms of the Treaty of Guarantee and in accordance with the right they had of separate intervention to restore the basic state of affairs existing in 1960. I think that was a their position was defensible for the first phase of their intervention, but not perhaps later on. At this stage, the British declined to come in with the Turks and confined themselves to getting the three guarantors together in Geneva and trying to work out a settlement. The Turks were very tough, as one could expect, I suppose, at this time. And while the negotiations were actually going on, some very dreadful atrocities occurred in the central plain of Cyprus. A couple of Turkish villages were virtually wiped out by Greek National Guard. I think there's no doubt that similar, though perhaps not as sizable, atrocities did occur on the other side as well. In a situation of that kind, these terrible things do happen. The result was that the Turks felt they could issue an ultimatum, and they produced a plan for Turkish cantons, a cantonal a settlement, and put it to the Greeks, and as it happened to the British as well, on a take it or leave it basis. And the Greeks asked for time to consider it, and Callaghan supported them in that, and the Turks refused, gave a deadline, and when their proposals weren't accepted, they then went in for their second operation, which greatly extended the area under their control. Who knows what they were really what their motives really were at that stage. I think it's true they'd found the original invasion more difficult than they had expected and had not pushed their lines as far as they had planned. And so the military, anyway, whether that, this goes to the government as well, I don't know, but the military were pleased to have the opportunity of a second round and establishing the kind of lines which they thought would be easy to defend and which gave them control virtually of the whole of the north of Cyprus.
That would be the line which is in existence today, is it?
More or less, yes. Right.